from the UW Marathon County Theater. Welcome to the U.S. Senate debate between incumbent Democrat Russ Feingold and Republican Ron Johnson. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. We want to thank tonight's other sponsors, the Wausau Daily Herald, WAOW, ABC TV 9, WSAW, CBS TV 7, both of Wausau, and the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Thanks also to Dean Sandy Smith and the staff at UW Marathon County for making this event possible. Our panelists tonight are Robert Mentzer of the Wausau Daily Herald, Pam Warnke of WAOW-TV, and Eric Morotek of WSAW-TV. Here's the format. The candidates will have opening statements of 90 seconds each. Then our panelists will pose individual questions. The candidates will have 90 seconds to respond to each question, at which point the panelist will ask a follow-up. The candidates will then have about 3 minutes and no more than 5 minutes to respond to the follow-up at the moderator's discretion in a free-form discussion period in which the candidates can elaborate on their positions, question each other, and respond to each other's statements. If we get through all six questions and there is time remaining, I will ask a seventh and final question. The debate will conclude with 60-second closing statements for each candidate. We expect everyone in the audience to treat this debate and each of the candidates with respect and dignity. Outbursts, heckling, and other disruptions will not be tolerated and will lead to ejection from the theater. Please turn off your cell phones if you haven't already. And finally, the theater doors have been closed for the event. If you need to leave, you will not be let back in and will be directed instead to an overflow room. And now a round of applause, please, for our two candidates, Senator Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson. And now that you've applauded, I'm going to ask you to do something difficult and refrain from applause until the end of the debate. By the toss of a coin, Senator Russ Feingold has the first opening statement. Senator Feingold, you have 90 seconds.
Thank you, Glenn. Thanks to the whole greater Wausau community for your leadership in making this debate possible. I, of course, grew up in this state, lived here all my life, and I've been instilled in the idea of Wisconsin independence, political independence in particular. And that's had a big impact on the way I've done this job. Some people say I'm the most independent member of the Senate. It's the reason that I voted against that TARP deal, that Wall Street bailout. It's the reason that I voted against all those unfair trade agreements that sent tens of thousands of Wisconsin jobs overseas. It's even the reason, as you know here in Marathon County, that I voted against that No Child Left Behind bill, which forces teachers to teach to the test and takes away local control of education. But I go to all 72 counties every year and hear what people's priorities are. And you all know what the priorities are. It's jobs and cutting federal spending. I have offered specific plans on jobs and federal spending, a jobs tax credit, and a 41-point plan to cut $500 billion out of the federal budget. My opponent has chosen in 6 months of campaigning to do nothing of the kind. He hasn't offered a jobs plan. He hasn't offered a specific plan to cut federal spending. But I'm still hoping we can have a discussion about it tonight. Thanks so much.
And Ron Johnson, you have 90 seconds.
Thank you. Well, good evening. 6 months ago, I was a full-time businessman running a manufacturing plant that I've been building for 31 years. I had no political aspirations. This is not my life's ambition. But our country is heading in the wrong direction. People are out of work. Families are struggling, and they're worried. And the response from Washington has been incredibly ineffective and extremely expensive. Our nation's debt now stands at $13.4 trillion, and it is threatening the future prosperity of America. Wisconsin voters have a very clear choice. They can vote for a career politician whose votes in Washington have exploded the deficit and expanded the size and scope of the federal government, or they can vote for a citizen legislator, someone who has private sector experience creating jobs and balancing a budget, someone who's had a full career, raised a family, and is willing to apply that lifetime experience a little common sense to our nation's problems. That's what I have to offer. That's what I'd like to talk about tonight. Thank you.
And our first question comes from Rob Mentzer of the Wausau Daily Herald.
Thanks, Glenn. Our first question deals with the health care reform law. Critics have argued that the law was passed through Congress without bipartisan support, with a bare minimum number of votes, and against the will of most of the American people. And yet there are also many provisions in the bill that are broadly agreed to be improvements to the current system, things like closing the donut hole in Medicare Part D, preventing insurance companies from discriminating against people with pre-existing conditions, and other things. For Senator Feingold, I'd like to ask, why did you vote for a bill that most in Wisconsin opposed? And for Mr. Johnson, you've campaigned on repealing the law, but wouldn't that also mean doing away with the positive provisions that are included in it and things that, as well as the things that you argue would be harmful?
We're going to go first with Senator Feingold. You have 90 seconds.
Thanks for the question. First, you know, I got to reject out of hand the idea that the people of Wisconsin oppose this. I've done town meetings in every one of Wisconsin's 72 counties for the last 6 years since I got reelected. And when I ran, I said, if you elect me, I'm going to try to do something to have national health care legislation. And the evidence we have is that 60% of Wisconsinites favored us doing something over those years, and 40% probably didn't want us to do it. In fact, right here in Marathon County, in the heat of all those tough town meetings, it was about 50-50. So I had to figure out what Wisconsin people really wanted. And what we came up with was a plan that I think makes sense. It is not the takeover of the health care system by the federal government, which Mr. Johnson likes to say it is. It just didn't do that. It's really a compromise. It's sort of in the Wisconsin tradition. For like 100 years, we have had a strong private insurance system here, but with strong regulation of insurance. In fact, we have the strongest regulation of insurance through the insurance commissioner of almost any state. That's what this bill really does. And, of course, your question anticipates the really big deal, which is we finally have the insurance companies out of the complete control of our lives. We have some controls on pre-existing condition denials. And every young person under 26 can stay on their parents' plan until they're 26, which I think is a great thing. So the bill is a good compromise that I think brings the country forward on the number one issue that's been brought up to me over the years. I felt absolutely obligated to get something done, and I'm very proud that we did.
And, Mr. Johnson, you've got 90 seconds.
Sure, thank you. The health care bill was just an incredibly expensive and complicated overreach by the federal government. We didn't need a 2,600-page bill passed in the middle of the night to address the problems that do exist in our health care bill or health care industry. If you really think about what are the primary problems, it's cost and it's access. And if you think about what the administration, Senator Feingold, said this bill would do, the first thing they said it would save every family $2,500. Per year on their health insurance. Well, the Congressional Budget Office now has the figures in. They estimate it'll cost each family $2,100. And now families are starting to get those premium increases. They're seeing there was no cost control whatsoever. They said they'd bend the cost curve down. That didn't happen. In terms of accessibility, if you remember the other guarantee they made, if you like your health care plan, your private plan, you can keep it. Well, their own agencies, Health and Human Services and IRS, issued a report and said 51% of current plans will not be grandfathered. They will be put in the government exchanges. So that will be government-controlled, government-regulated health care. So it was a shame because I think we had a consensus to actually address the problems in our health care industry, and we could have done it with individual bills to address those problems. I would have started with tort reform. You know, why wasn't that addressed? That could have saved $200 to $300 billion in junk lawsuits and unnecessary defensive medicine that doctors have to practice.
And Rob Mentzer, you've got a follow-up.
Well, I mean, I'd like to follow up with Mr. Johnson. You have said that you favor repealing the law, and I do. I just want to ask again, does that not risk sort of doing away with the provisions like the pre-existing condition or the Medicare Part D donut hole closing? For Senator Feingold, the follow-up would be, you argued for things like the public option and other ways that the bill could have gone further. Do you think that there's still more to be done on healthcare reform, and what would those steps look like?
Well, do I start?
You've got 3 minutes.
Again, the individual problems facing healthcare could have been addressed with individual bills. We didn't have to take $500 billion away from Medicare. We didn't have to increase taxes $500 billion. We didn't have to put on 16,000 additional IRS agents. What does that have to do with healthcare? You know, we certainly didn't have to put in the provision, the 1099 provision, that would require every small business person to put in a government form, submit a government form to their suppliers and to the IRS every time they purchase more than $600 worth of supplies. And Senator Feingold, there was actually an attempt to strip that out, to repeal that. Senator Feingold voted against that repeal. So, again, this is a huge overreach. It's incredibly complex. It is designed, by the way, to take over, to privatize, or to go to a single-payer, government-run health care. Barney Frank said as much. He said, this is the first step along the path to a single payer. And quite honestly, Senator Feingold, that's exactly what Senator Feingold wants. He wants a single payer government-run solution.
I want what I voted for. I want this bill because I think it's the right solution. Yes, I would have preferred a public option. I think it would have made it even stronger. But Mr. Johnson says we should have just passed individual bills to deal with all these problems. Guess what? We tried to pass all these things individually, and the insurance companies killed every single one of them. We tried to have a patient's bill of rights for years. We had a huge effort, a bipartisan effort. The insurance companies killed it. We got it in this bill. They've killed the ability of us to make sure that over a million Wisconsinites are protected from being denied a coverage because of a pre-existing condition. By putting it in this bill, we've got the protection. They've been able to let insurance companies completely prevent people from being able to have lifetime coverage because of lifetime limits on their coverage. And that was eliminated in this bill. And, of course, the big thing you mentioned is we finally got that donut hole filled. We've got seniors between $2,000 and $6,000 of expenditures are getting absolutely no coverage for their prescription drugs. We tried to do that before, Ron, couldn't do it. So the idea of doing it bill by bill, it ain't going to happen. It happened because we got together and did a package that really finally put us in control and took the insurance companies out of control, and I sure don't want to see that repealed.
Mr. Johnson, do you have anything to add?
Well, it certainly will put the government in control, and that's the problem. The government will get in control and get between the doctor and the patient. It is designed for government takeover. When these plans go into the government exchanges, the government is going to totally regulate which insurance companies can even participate in that. And Senator Feingold, that's exactly what you wanted. I am a little confused in terms of what you want, though, because 6 years ago in a debate with Tim Michael, you said you want a 50-state solution, just like Tommy Thompson's welfare reform. You wanted a 50-state solution. But then a few years later, when asked, what about single-payer health care, you said, I'm for it. I always have
that. Well, this is, of course, a 50-state solution. These individual exchanges, Ron, are separate state private insurance plans. It is not one national plan. And so that's exactly what we ended up doing, and it isn't in place yet. Couldn't possibly know what the rates are going to be at this point because we haven't even got it in place yet. How could you possibly know? It is going to be a state-based system, private system, but we're going to finally make sure the insurance companies don't run our lives.
Let's go now to Pam Warnke. She has the second question. Pam?
Let's turn to the economy now. Senator Feingold, some argue that the massive economic policies meant to improve the economy have done little to turn it around. How do you respond to concerns from voters that these policies aren't creating jobs or helping working families? And Mr. Johnson, you say that most politicians have no experience creating jobs in the private sector, and you tout your business background as strong credentials in this race. Why do you think your experience in business better qualifies you to craft job-creating and economic policies than someone with a background in policy creation? After all, the country is not a private business. And what specific kinds of policies will you support to help create jobs?
We go first to Mr. Johnson and then Senator sure. Feingold.
Well, I think, first of all, you have to understand where real jobs are created, real long-term self-sustaining jobs, and that's in the private sector. And, of course, I've been doing that for 31 years. I've been producing products, and I've been creating real jobs for 31 years. I understand that. You know, when they pass a stimulus bill, of course, the assumption of that is the government can actually provide long-term jobs, and it doesn't. I mean, the fact of the matter is Senator Feingold cast a deciding vote for the failed stimulus package. And 3 days before he cast that deciding vote, he issued a press release and said it would create 2.4 million jobs in the first year and 9 million jobs after 3 years. Obviously, that doesn't come true. You know, we're a year and a half into this. We should be up 4.5 million jobs, but we're in fact down 2.6 million jobs. So it does require the knowledge and the experience of realizing how do you create a job? You know, what are the incentives and disincentives? You know, what effect do the rules, the regulations, and the taxes the government imposes on the private sector, how does that impact business creation, job creation? I understand what that is. I think it's a different perspective. It's a perspective that is sorely lacking in Washington. I mean, I do have the one ad out there. We've got 57 lawyers in the Senate. We have zero manufacturers. We have one accountant. You know, our country is facing some very serious fiscal issues in this country. I think a little accounting background, a little business perspective is long overdue, and that's what I have. That's what I'm offering the Wisconsin voters.
Senator Feingold, you've got 90 seconds.
Well, let's see if we can get away from attacking other people's jobs and career choices and talk about the question. The question is whether this recovery that we've been trying to do has worked at all. You know, Ron, your arguments about this that I've heard time and again were carefully evaluated in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel yesterday. They said you were completely wrong. about your claim that the recovery bill did nothing. You've never addressed the fact that 95% of all working families in this country got a tax cut under that bill. Is that something we should just sneeze at and reject? Under this bill, we have seven times more road construction in the country than last year. If anybody tried to get here tonight, you probably figured that out. That has a lot to do with it. We have 80,000 more weatherization of homes across this country. And I've been to the sites in Ashland and Stevens Point where this is happening. And guess who's doing that work? It's not government employees. It's not IRS agents. It's your local heating and cooling people. It's your local construction people that are doing that work. But I am the first to admit that the recovery bill was an emergency and only a single step. It was not meant to create permanent jobs, but it did, in fact, according to the CBO, create somewhere between 1.5 and 3 million jobs, and that's something I would think you'd want us to have and not have forgotten about. Finally, the HIRE Act that we added on top of it actually provides jobs for people and companies who have been laid off for over 60 days. The company gets an exemption from their payroll tax for the whole rest of the year if they hire somebody. So we have built these two, and they are beginning to make a good difference. And
Pam Warnke, you have a follow-up?
How seriously do you take the threat of climate change, particularly as it relates to the economy? Will you push for the creation of green energy jobs and policies that embrace alternative energy?
And whichever one of you wants to go first, go first.
I'm happy to go first. I simply don't believe that global warming is proven science. Man-caused global warming. And as a result, the last thing we can afford to do is penalize our economy, tax energy, up to $1 trillion. It would be incredibly devastating for the state of Wisconsin, for example. And this is a bill that Senator Feingold voted for cloture on the Senate, very similar to the House bill, that would have increased the average cost of household energy per family $1,600 to $4,000. It could have cost Wisconsin 40,000 to 60,000 jobs. So certainly on the basis of unproven science, I would not support any kind of cap-and-trade legislation.
Well, look, I do not substitute my judgment. I wouldn't substitute my judgment on manufacturing for you, and I sure as heck wouldn't substitute my judgment for the vast majority of scientists in the world who say that climate change is real and that man has something to do with it. I respect those scientists, and I think they're right. And I think we better do something about it. Mr. Johnson has said specifically that it would be a fool's errand to do anything about it. Well, that's just ignoring our responsibility to our children and grandchildren and to our whole ability to have a planet that people can live on. But, Ron, it's just not true that I voted for a cap-and-trade bill. When that House passed that bill, I said, wait a minute. I don't want it to hurt the Wisconsin economy. We have a more coal-based economy than other states. And that bill was cooked in favor of the nuclear industry. So I let people know that I was not going to support it. I let the administration know, and I'm one of the reasons that bill didn't get through, because I am very concerned that ratepayers in Wisconsin and businesses in Wisconsin do not get hurt by what we need to do to try to solve this problem. But just sticking our head in the sand and thinking that somehow this is caused by sunspots does not solve the problem.
Mr. Johnson, do you have a response to that?
Well, certainly Senator Feingold did vote for cloture on the Lieberman Warner bill, which was a very similar bill to the House bill, and would have had the same type of impact as the House bill. So, you know, I think he did vote to move it forward.
Well, moving a bill forward so you can discuss it and debate it is part of the process. I don't know, Ron, if you want me to like vote against debating bills. Recently, there was a financial regulation bill in the Senate that you actually agreed with my vote on that thing. And you know, I voted to have us take it up. You know, what are we going to do? Never debate bills? And I tried to amend it, and the amendments were lousy. And I became the only Democrat to vote, not with the Republicans, because they wanted to be even weaker, but I was the only person to not vote for it because it didn't do the job. So the notion that you could say that because I voted to debate a bill that somehow I was for the substance of the bill, I'm the strongest advocate to make sure this bill doesn't rip off Wisconsin, and I will always be.
As devastating as that would have been for the economy of Wisconsin, you should not have voted for cloture. You shouldn't have allowed that thing to move forward.
Let's move on to Eric Morotek. You have the next question, Eric.
We're going to turn now to Social Security. According to the Congressional Budget Office, Social Security will be able to pay full benefits to every recipient until the year 2039. Still, there are concerns as more Americans age and retire that the money will run out. I believe there's also a resolution going through the House and Senate right now that calls for no cuts to the program at all. My question to you is, are changes needed? And if so, what would they be? And how would you ensure that those who pay into the system now will see something when they retire?
And we're going to start with Mr. Johnson and then Senator Feingold. I'm mixed up here. It's Senator Feingold and Mr.
Johnson. That's
what I
thought, but I wasn't going to argue with the moderator. look, first of all, we know how to do this. It was done in the past. What you got to do, and this is one of the cases where you have to do this, is basic. Take it out of the hands of the Congress and create a commission, which was done in the early 80s. That is a bipartisan commission that creates a package to create improve the solvency of the program, and then send it back to Congress and not allow any amendments. That's what they did, and that's how we first got into the practice of raising up that FICA level, that amount you pay out for Social Security in your paycheck. It was way down around $60,000. They created a graduation in that has helped keep the fund solvent to the date that you set. But it's not high enough. It only goes to about $106,000. In every county in the state, people have said, why don't you raise that FICA limit way up? And I would strongly propose that, but we have to do it to get it through, have a commission to do it. What I will not tolerate, however, is changing the program fundamentally. I strongly oppose any form of privatization of Social Security. I will oppose any attempt to have people's accounts, whether they're already in Social Security or whether in the future, to go to Wall Street where they can risk losing their Social Security, which is fundamental for so many people's lives. Mr. Johnson has specifically said that as to people who are not yet in Social Security, everything's on the table, and that obviously includes some forms of privatization. I will fight that every inch of the way.
Mr. Johnson, you've got 90 seconds now.
I certainly recognize that promises have been made to seniors, people that are currently retired, people that are about to retire. And our country certainly has every capability of honoring those promises, and I'll be dedicated to honoring those promises. But the fiscal problems of Social Security that we are facing in the future, they've been known for decades. They've certainly been known during the 18 years that Senator Feingold has been there. And he's done nothing to fix Social Security. He uses it as a political weapon. He's very good at doing that. But he's never done anything to fix Social Security. Instead, he's spent more money. He's incurred more debt, which would just make it that much more difficult for us actually to fix the problem. As a matter of fact, during his tenure, $2.2 trillion have been paid into Social Security. And the American people, by and large, thought, well, that's being tucked away. That's being set aside. It's not being touched. No, it's been spent. It was spent on other government programs. The money's gone. So certainly what I'd like to do is take my accounting background, my business background, and a dedication to actually, you know, go into Washington and address this problem and make Social Security sustainable long term. And I will look at all the options. I think you have to have an open mind. You have to be flexible about this. The only two options I would take off the table is I would not agree to a job-killing payroll tax increase, and I would never force privatization on anybody. He'll continue to claim I would. I would not. I would not force privatization on anybody.
And Eric Morotek, you have a follow-up.
I do. When we talk about Social Security, naturally the next thing to come is Medicare, Medicaid. Similar concerns about funding there as well. What do you see is the government's role in providing health care to the growing number of elderly as well as the needy, and does the current system there need a change?
Well, first of all, with regard to Social Security, the notion that the fund is currently insolvent is absolutely false. As you said, it goes till 2039, and it is simply a scare tactic to try to pretend that anything else is true. It is solvent, and actually the Medicare program, which I'm going to address now, is in more need of getting reform in the near term. Well, that's exactly what the health care bill does. The bill that Mr. Johnson would repeal as his first act has been specifically analyzed to make sure that Medicare is solvent for 12 more years. And we do that not by cutting Medicare benefits. He's got a mailer out that says we're cutting senior citizens Medicare guaranteed benefits. That's absolutely untrue. It doesn't do that. What it does do is cut $400 to $500 billion out of the program that actually goes to wasteful aspects of Medicare Advantage and to all kinds of waste, fraud, and abuse. So if he has his way and repeals the bill, we'll eliminate the best step we've taken to make Medicare solvent in the future. We need to protect the Medicare benefits for all seniors. I do not believe in cutting back on them, and the only way to do it is to be responsible, and that's exactly what we did in the health care bill.
We are in an open discussion period, Mr. Johnson.
Well, as of Social Security, we do need to honor those promises, and I'll be dedicated to do that as well to people who are retired and about to retire. Medicare is a huge problem. The total unfunded liability of our three main entitlement programs is $76 trillion. Our total U.S. asset base, according to the U.S. debt clock, is $72 trillion. It's a real problem. It needs to be addressed, and it needs to be addressed honestly.
If I could just respond to it. Excuse me.
Oh, well.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say the way you don't address or try and fix Medicare is create a whole new entitlement, add another entitlement as an unfunded liability, and take $500 billion away from Medicare. It will. There are 175,000 seniors in Wisconsin that will not have their Medicare Advantage. They like that program. So this, the new health care entitlement is really, you can take a look at it as somewhat of a redistribution of health care from seniors to an entirely new group of people. That's a problem. That is not, you don't fix one entitlement program by, you know, creating a whole new one that's going to be a huge budget buster.
Look at the exchange we just had. I guess this is my point about the whole difference between the two of us. You know, I offered a specific solution with regard to Social Security, raising the FICA level above 106,000. He specifically rejected it. No solution, no alternative, just I'm not going to do that. Then on Medicare, I pointed out that we had a specific thing in the health care bill that he wants to repeal, two areas that all the official estimates say are going to make Medicare solvent for the future. He doesn't have any answer. He doesn't have any plan. He just wants to say we've got all this debt and all these problems, but he gives you absolutely no idea what he would do about it. That's the easy way. That's the way you don't have to face criticism. But it's not the responsibility you need from a U.S. senator.
I have a very specific proposal. We repeal the health care bill. That will save trillions.
Precisely.
That will save trillions in unfunded liability, trillions in deficit spending over the next decades. And it will restore the $500 billion that's been taken away and taken out of the Medicare program.
And the insurance companies, that was the
worst possible thing to try and preserve Medicare.
The insurance companies will get their fair chunk of that back, you bet.
Let's go on to Rob Mentzer. You have the next question.
Mr. Johnson, you have called Ayn Rand's book Atlas Shrugged a foundational book for you. The book paints a heroic portrait of a group of rich businessmen who leave society to escape from the poor, who are basically portrayed as social parasites in the book. And Rand also endorses selfishness as a virtue. She wrote a book by that title. What is it about her philosophy that appeals to you, and what makes that a foundational book for you? For Senator Feingold, the aspects of Rand's thought that tend to appeal to conservatives, libertarians, is her strong defense of individual liberty and her opposition to any form of, you know, collectivism. So do you agree with the notion that much social spending amounts to redistribution of wealth?
And Mr. Johnson, you have 90 seconds.
Sure. I'll first dispute your description of what Atlas Shrugged really is talking about. But the way I describe it is just take a look at the title of the book, Atlas Shrugged. Atlas represents the producers of America, of the country. Shrugged means they have become so overburdened with regulations and rules and taxes that at some point they just shrug, they quit. They don't quit all at once. They quit one by one. And what the book talks about in a fictionalized manner is what happens to society when the producers of the society quit. Again, because they've been so overburdened by rules and regulations and taxes. And it is a warning. It's a warning what could happen to America. And when you hear people talking about a tipping point, that's what we're concerned about. That's what I'm concerned about, what's happening to this country, where we have more people that are net beneficiaries of government than are actually paying into the system. That's a very serious thing to worry about. And that's why, from my standpoint, Atlas Shrugged is a huge warning in terms of what we need to avoid in this country.
And Senator Feingold, you have 90 seconds.
Well, I believe in a community. I believe in the community of Wisconsin, and I give you credit for being consistent with Atlas Shrugged. You believe the producers are a very special group of people. I guess they're better than the rest of us. So if things aren't going their way, you take the position that people shouldn't have unemployment compensation, because your view has been that they just don't want to work. You oppose minimum wage. You support trade agreements that ship tens of thousands of jobs of many of the people in this community overseas, and you say, well, I'm a producer, so that's good because it's creative destruction. It'll all work out in the end. Well, it might work out in the end for you and other people who are very well-to-do and fortunate. But what about all the other people in the community who are suffering? I don't think these people should ever be allowed to not work if they can work. And I know people in Wisconsin, they want to work. But these policies that you support are making it impossible for these hardworking Wisconsinites to make a decent living. And I assume that makes them shrug as well.
And Rob Menser, you have a follow-up?
Well, one part of this, the discussion about sort of wealth redistribution has to do with the progressive nature of the tax code. And this has been part of the debate about, for instance, the Bush tax cuts set to expire, which included larger tax reductions for those in the upper income brackets than for those middle class workers and others. So to get sort of specific on some of these ideas, does it make sense for the Bush tax cuts to be extended even for the wealthiest individuals?
And this is a free-form discussion period.
Well, I think that we have to have common sense on this because Mr. Johnson and I both have talked about the federal deficit. He calls it the tipping point, and I don't even disagree with that. So wait a minute. We're at a tipping point. Can we really afford to make the federal deficit much larger right now? I think we have to figure out a common sense solution. And the common sense solution is to extend the tax cuts, middle-class tax cuts, for working people. In fact, it even benefits wealthy people to some extent. But those tax cuts that are just for the very wealthy, we can't afford it. It's $700 billion over the next 10 years. That's going to create a tipping point just by itself. So we have to come up with a solution that makes sense, and that is the right compromise at this point that I would support. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Johnson opposed the tax cuts for working people that are in the stimulus bill, in the Recovery Act. That was for 95% of all working families in America. There are tax cuts for businesses in the health care bill, and the HIRE Act provides some $6 billion of tax cuts for businesses. I think those tax cuts should be acknowledged as well.
Senator Feingold continues to put words in my mouth, things I never said. I'm not opposed to minimum wage. I'm not opposed to extension of unemployment benefits. The fact that we're even talking about that, to me, is exhibit one, how much this stimulus failed. And the last thing we should be doing is increasing taxes on anybody in this weak recovery. And when he's talking about that top bracket, what he's talking about is 750,000 businesses. 750,000 businesses that employ 25% of the total workforce. Those are the individual businesses that pay under the individual tax. Those are the engines for economic growth. And I am all for the workers of Wisconsin. I think that's actually a huge difference. I export product. I produce products. I export products to about 25 different countries. One of our largest export markets is China. I've got faith in the workers of Wisconsin and faith in the workers of America that if we can get government out of the way, if we can make sure that government just creates an attractive environment for business creation and job creation, Wisconsin workers, American workers can compete with anybody in the world. You know, we live in a global economy. It's not whether we choose to compete. We have to compete. I've got the faith in the Wisconsin workers that we can compete because I do it every day. And I'm extremely supportive of the workers that work for me and of the workers of Wisconsin.
See, now here's the difference again. He's only talking about 5% of all the businesses. 95% of the small businesses in the country would not experience a tax increase if we didn't do the increase for the cut for the very wealthy. This is a big myth out there. Now, how does it work that the only businesses that are worthwhile, the only producers that are worthwhile, are the ones that are very well-to-do? Most of the jobs are created by people of average income and modest income. They are the engine of the economy of the state in this country, and they should not be disregarded in this way.
We're going to move now to Pam Warnke with the next question.
The United States foreign policy, particularly in the Middle and Near East, is taking a massive monetary and human toll. The war in Afghanistan, now in its 10th year, and is spilling in over to the borders into Pakistan. Despite the end of major combat in Iraq, the U.S. still has 50,000 troops in that country. Can the U.S. afford the current strategy abroad? What specific kinds of policies do you support that will bring about a successful conclusion to our military presence, but also keep Americans safe?
Senator Feingold, then Mr. Johnson.
We can't afford this unwise approach to those who attacked us in 9/11, and that's Al-Qaeda. Obviously, the Iraq war had essentially nothing to do with that and was incredibly expensive. The Afghanistan war originally had to do with that, and I supported it, but now the leadership of Al-Qaeda is not in Afghanistan. They are principally in places like Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia and other places. This is costing us $100 billion a year. and we just can't afford it, and it also isn't the way to get at the enemy. So I've taken the lead in the Senate in saying, look, why don't we have a timetable that the president would propose to gradually bring those troops out of Afghanistan? I think he's beginning to look at that. And I was a senator who listened to Wisconsin people that first proposed that idea for Iraq, and they're following through on it. At first, people said, well, we don't think that's a good idea, but then Bush ultimately endorsed it, and Obama did, and it is the reason that the troops are coming home. We have to have priorities, and our priority has to be going after al-Qaeda and making sure we don't dig another huge deficit, which is exactly what these unwise interventions are doing.
And, Mr. Johnson, you have 90 seconds.
We do need to recognize that we still are under the threat of terrorism. And certainly what we're trying to do in Afghanistan is deny a sanctuary for those terrorists. You know, that's where they launched the attacks on 9/11. And certainly we've got to be mindful of where else they may be hiding. We need a very strong intelligence capability. And I'm not sure exactly, you know, how Senator Feingold has tried to weaken our intelligence capability over his career. But in terms of basic philosophy, in terms of putting our fine young men and women, let's acknowledge that. The people that step to the plate to defend our freedom and protect our nation are the finest among us, and they need our total support. So before we do that, you know, certainly I look at it through the lens of, is there a vital interest for America at stake? Is there a clear and present danger? And I'm somewhat at a disadvantage here because, of course, I don't see the intelligence reports. But certainly President Obama does. And for whatever reason, he's seeing something there that he decided to surge 30,000 troops. Now, I will say my one concern is, in announcing that surge, in the next sentence, he said, we're going to start withdrawing in 16 months, particularly in a conflict like Afghanistan, where we need the support of the villagers and we need the support of the Afghan people to not make that commitment, to not be committed to success, makes your chance of success extremely difficult. So I just think that's unfortunate.
Well, if I could respond to this notion.
Just a second, Senator Pam Warnke, you have a follow-up?
With all of that being said, what does it mean to win in Afghanistan? Is that the place we need to win?
Now, Senator, you can respond, Mr. Johnson can respond.
This has been the mistake of the last 9 years. It isn't about invading one country after another. It's about attacking an organization that's present in many countries in the world. So it's not about winning in Afghanistan. It's about destroying al-Qaeda wherever they might be. And the notion that Mr. Johnson, who I respect what he does in his business, but Ron, for 5 years I've been on the Intelligence Committee, and I've worked day and night to try to figure out exactly where this threat is. People in the military, people in the intelligence community consider me to be the person that has worked the hardest to understand the threat of al-Qaeda in places like Africa. So the notion that you dismiss that as weakening America, I'll tell you something, Ron, that's just dead wrong, and it's unfair. Here's the other thing, and I'm glad you mentioned it. We need to honor these people that are fighting for us over there when they come home, too. And I took the lead in this state in making sure that there are veteran centers for people that have mental health issues and other issues when they come back. We got one in Green Bay. We got one in La Crosse. And, yes, there will now be one in Wausau because of my efforts. So I believe in honoring and supporting our troops both there and when they come home. And I've been honored by the National Organization of the Veteran Service Officers as the number one legislator in the country this year for my work on behalf of those veterans.
I would like to ask you, why didn't you vote? You're only one of, I think, 25 senators that refused to vote for the resolution condemning your supporting group, MoveOn.org, when they placed, I thought, a very shameful ad in the New York Times that talked about General Petraeus. Why didn't you vote to condemn that act?
I'll tell you why, because I believe in freedom of speech. I don't think senators should be sitting around spending time condemning people's comments. We should be working on the deficit. We should be working on jobs. So I'm not going to vote for any resolution that wastes our time by trying to chill the speech of anybody. That's not the job we have to do in the Senate. That is against freedom.
It doesn't show a great deal of support for our troops.
I don't think our troops want us sitting around all day passing resolutions going, hey, he said that, and, you know, the next day we got to pass a resolution about what Rush Limbaugh said. That's all we'd ever do, Ron. This is serious work we do in the Senate. Standing around monitoring these people on the extremes is not what we should be doing.
And let's move to Eric Marotik, who has the next question.
Can't we all just get along?
Absolutely.
Boy, that timed out well. It seems as though the partisan fighting and bickering is the order of day in Washington. It often appears like the only business being done is one party blocking the other. So how do you if elected, intend to get past that, get some bipartisan action going, and share the responsibility of governing that you've been given by the voters, or can such a thing even be done?
And we start with Mr. Johnson and then Senator Feingold. You have 90 seconds.
Well, certainly. I've got a record of problem solving, of actually getting things done. And particularly in my community over the last 10 years, I've been highly involved in education issues. And you're dealing with all types of people. But the focus has always been on actually accomplishing something, attacking problems and fixing problems, solving problems. And I take that exact same type of attitude to Washington because it's extremely important. We are talking about record deficits. Since Senator Feingold's party gained control of the Congress, our deficits have exploded. Record deficit of $450 billion the first year, then $1.4 trillion, now another $1.4 trillion. In just the last three budgets, we've added $3 trillion to our nation's debt. These are some pretty serious problems, and they do require a seriousness of purpose. You know, somebody actually wanted to go there and genuinely attack these problems. That's why I'm doing this. I mean, I stated in my opening, this is not my life's ambition. This is just somebody from, a guy from Oshkosh, a business guy who takes a look at what's happening in this country and says, at some point in time, somebody's got to step up the plate and go to Washington with goodwill in a bipartisan fashion. That doesn't mean I'm going to, leave my principles behind, but actually go there with a dedication to address these problems and get them solved once and for all. That's why I'm doing this. I'm not going there to bicker. I'm not going there to be partisan. I'm going there to solve problems.
And Senator Feingold, you have 90 seconds.
Well, the question was about, how would you actually do bipartisan things? And I want to answer this question by pointing out that I probably have been involved in more bipartisan initiatives than any other senator. I think it's 40. I mean, for me to have to apologize, to say that I wasn't bipartisan after being the co-author of the best-known bipartisan bill the last 30 years, the McCain-Feingold bill, you might not like it, but there are a lot of others, like Paul Ryan and I. Of Wisconsin. He's a conservative Republican. The thing I like best about him, he's from Janesville, too. But we proposed a line item veto, which the president has endorsed. Susan Collins of Maine and I she's a Republican, and we've introduced legislation about areas where children can't get adequate dental care, some areas not too far from here. We were the leaders on that. And I have to say, Ron, the other night you actually mentioned somebody that you had done, as you said, cooperative work with, Mr. Len Herricks from Oshkosh. He wrote a letter to the paper saying that wasn't his experience with you at all. And he supports me for the U.S. Senate.
And Eric Marotek, you have a follow-up.
I do. No, it seems like a lot of the contention between the parties is played out with the use of the filibuster and even the anonymous hold that's put on legislation, both of which seem to contradict this principle that a simple majority wins. Since these are simply Senate rules and not constitutionally mandated, do you support changing them or perhaps even eliminating them?
And we're in a free-form discussion period of about 3 minutes.
Well, I really respect the fact that the founders of this country created a constitution that I've studied carefully that really tries to create some kind of balance between the House and the Senate. And so I think the Senate has to have rules where things just don't go flying through. They tend to do that in the House. Ron, that's why I, slowed down that cap-and-trade bill. That's what the Senate was able to do, was to make sure that didn't pass too fast because we have these rules. I do think it's kind of being abused now, though. It's being used on almost every bill to prevent us from ever bringing anything up. Both parties have been involved in it. I think it's worse right now. But, one answer might be, right now we have to have all 60 senators who want to get cloture present, but the rest of them can be in the Bahamas. They don't have to be there. So one solution would be 60% of everybody present. Senators tend to like their weekends, so making them be there, I think, could help reduce this abuse. But I do not want to completely eliminate Thomas Jefferson's idea. Thomas Jefferson said the Senate should be the cooling saucer for the House, and he was a pretty smart guy, so I don't want to toss that out.
And we are in a free-form discussion period.
I agree the Senate should be the deliberative body. And I support that. I mean, it is where legislation should be really looked at very carefully, and those rules are there for a reason, to stop something. And, Senator Feingold says he's, so bipartisan. Two of the most partisan bills were passed last year with him being the deciding vote. I mean, taking over, remaking one-sixth of our economy, the health care bill, there wasn't one Republican. There was no bipartisanship about that. The Republicans just shown the back of the Democrats' hands. And he provided the 60th vote, incredibly partisan. And I'd say the same thing was true in terms of the stimulus bill. There was no input. They just rushed that. They just rushed it, you know, threw $1 trillion at the wall, hoping that would stick, hoping that would create jobs, also on an entirely partisan basis. I think President Obama said, well, we won.
Well,
that isn't bipartisanship, and I think that's what the voters of Wisconsin are objecting to this year.
Well, no, they've
seen the record of the last 2 years.
No, that's just inaccurate. The recovery bill was not only Democrats. In fact, I wasn't even the deciding vote. There were 61 votes. Susan Collins voted for it. It was not just one party. I recognize it was mostly Democrats, but Ron, it's not true.
Pretty close.
I
stand corrected.
Well,
it was real close.
Okay. Well, if we're not going to have a process where you try to reach out to several Republicans to try to pass a bill, that's kind of sad for the U.S. Senate. If you have to have a situation where all 100 senators vote for something, that's kind of disturbing. And I think you should give credit to those Republicans who had the courage to work on a bipartisan basis. To do that. That was not an entirely partisan bill.
Mr. Johnson, do you have anything to add? All right. We do have time for a seventh question because both of you have been very succinct tonight. according to critics, the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United decision has opened the floodgates to unlimited amounts of cash being spent on negative campaign advertising by rich special interests, which under the decision don't even have to reveal their identities. How dangerous do you think this development is for democracy? Will this decision allow foreign governments or even terrorist groups to secretly fund campaign ads? Should we work to overturn the Citizens United decision? It's a Supreme Court decision, so if so, how? And what, if anything, should we do to keep big money from anonymous sources from influencing election outcomes? Senator Feingold, you have 90 seconds, and then Mr. Johnson.
It's easily one of the worst decisions in the history of the Supreme Court. It says that every one of you is in the same position as corporations. The corporations have the same political rights as you do. And the results of this are being seen in this election. There are millions of dollars being spent by out-of-state groups and ads against me, and I have not seen any ads on my behalf, and I don't want any ads like that. They are hidden. You don't know who's actually paying for them. There may well be foreign money involved. It is the destruction of our political process. And the founders of this country did not believe that corporations were the same as the rest of us. We can pass legislation to try to require some disclosure of this information, which, of course, I've supported in a bill called the Disclose Act. But fundamentally, we do need to overturn it. We're going to have to get one justice who realizes that this decision was completely wrong. Otherwise, our democracy is going to be completely submerged by the very powerful corporate interests that already dominate Washington. It's only going to get worse.
And, Mr. Johnson, you've got 90 seconds.
I think campaign finance reform should be pretty simple. I would be for total transparency and immediate or at least very rapid reporting on the Internet. We have the capability of doing that. That's what we need. We don't need to assault our individual rights to free speech. And that's really, I believe, what the McCain-Feingold, I call it the Incumbent Protection Act, because that's what it did. The intention of that thing was to supposedly clean up campaign finance, you know, make things more accountable. What it's done, it's push money outside the political process. It's push money into these 527 groups like MoveOn.org, where there is no accountability. There is no transparency. We have no idea who's funding these ads. Now, certainly, I don't like outside group ads. I don't like attack ads. I particularly don't like them now that I'm in the process and they're being used against me. So my solution is pretty simple. Let's do away with McCain-Feingold. Let's make this very simple. Let's have total transparency and immediate/rapid disclosure on the Internet. Then we know who is supporting each candidate, and we know it right away. And we can bring campaign finance back into the system where it's far more accountable than what it is today.
And the follow-up, according to analysts, campaign money spent by outside groups this year is helping Republicans instead of Democrats by a wide margin. Why is that? Democrats say corporate interests are trying to weaken the new Wall Street regulations and preserve tax breaks that encourage companies to send jobs overseas. Republicans say the spending is a reflection of deep dissatisfaction on the part of the American people with the policies of the Obama administration and the Democratic majority in Congress and the U.S. Senate. And we're into a free-form discussion.
I'll tell you, Mr. Johnson just refused to answer the question about Citizen United, and I'll tell you why, because he already endorsed it. He's all for it. He is benefiting tremendously in his campaign from millions of dollars of these ads, and I am not, and I don't want them. You say you don't want them? Will you call on them to stop?
I have no control over that.
Will you ask them to stop?
That's part of the problem. You have no control
over
that process.
Will you ask them to stop?
That's their right to free speech.
Will you ask them to stop? That's your right to free speech to say to them, stop.
People have a right to free speech, Senator Feingold.
Will you ask them to stop?
People have a right to free speech.
The answer is no. So here we are in Wisconsin. We're here in Wisconsin, and we want to have our own election, and a guy who wants to be your U.S. Senator will not simply use his free speech to say, will you please stop? That's how you should use your free speech.
By the way, to answer your question, I agree with people saying the reason there's more money being spent on the Republican side is there is a great deal of dissatisfaction. What's happened over the last 18 months, 2 years? I mean, people are concerned. People are very concerned about the total out-of-control spending and debt. They're concerned, and that's why they're putting their money where their concern is, and that is their right, and they should have that freedom.
The oil companies, the insurance companies, the mining companies, they are all very concerned. And they are hiding behind these ads because we finally are going to get some control over them.
Senator,
he's hiding behind ads that are nasty attack ads from out of state, and he refuses to call on them to stop. That is a direct attack on Wisconsin's political tradition of home-based campaigns.
Senator Feingold, it is individuals that are concerned about what's happening in their country, and they have a right to send their money into a particular group that agrees with their position, and those groups have a right to run ads. That's their freedom. And I'm not going to take that freedom away. You seem to want to do that. That's what some of the thrust of McCain-Feingold would be. You want to be able to select who can have free speech and who doesn't want to.
I want everybody to have free speech, but I want them to be able to, as you just said, they ought to disclose. You haven't even called on these people to disclose. You just said you're for disclosure. You won't even call on them to disclose.
I'd be happy to have them disclose.
Well, then why don't you ask them to do it?
Disclose. Okay. Let's see if that, frankly, I'm pretty sure you know darn well who's doing this. It's your law, Senator.
No, that isn't my law, Ron. This has nothing to do with McCain-Feingold law.
We have time for one additional question, and I don't know if we have time for a follow-up, so I'm going to give you each 90 seconds to give us what solutions you see for the problems of illegal immigration. And Mr. Johnson, we'll start with you, and then Senator Feingold. You each have 90 seconds.
Again, I believe this is relatively simple. I mean, it's a big problem, but the first step, it's got to be a two-step process. We have to secure the borders. I mean, as somebody who's never been involved in this process, I've always scratched my head going, why don't we just secure the border? I mean, I would not favor comprehensive reform because we tried that in the 80s. And what that did is that actually ended up being an incentive for more people to come over illegally because people granted amnesty, which, by the way, I'm totally against. But we secure the border. We also enforce the laws that are on our books against employers that are hiring these people, that are attracting people across the border. But the other thing you don't do is you don't pass laws that also create incentives for people to come here illegally. And Senator Feingold has voted for Social Security benefits being paid to illegal immigrants. He's voted for funding for sanctuary cities. He's voted for food stamps for illegal immigrants. All that does is that just creates an incentive for more illegal immigrants to come into our country. So you don't do those types of things. It's a two-step process. You have to first secure the border, enforce the laws in our books, and then once you've done that, then you take a look at you know who's left. You know, let the dust settle, and then we're a very caring society here. I'm all for treating the people that remain here in a very humane fashion.
And Senator Feingold, you have 90 seconds.
Well, of course, I don't support Social Security benefits for undocumented people. That's just absolutely false. But here's the problem. Again, Mr. Johnson doesn't want to solve the problem. And this is a problem that the business community of this state has screamed, do something about. All you want to do is secure the border. I agree with you on that. But you're just going to let all these people be undocumented in this country. Many of them are working here in Wisconsin. We need to figure out a common-sense solution for that now, not a two-step process, not let the dust settle. The whole Arizona debacle is going on because of that attitude. Just close the border. Hey, there are already people here. We've got to figure this out. Unless your plan is to take all these people and just pack them up and send them back, that is not an answer. The answer is somehow figuring out penalties and temporary work permits for these folks. And if they want to come back, another penalty. And then get in line behind everybody else for citizenship. You see, again, he doesn't want to really solve the problem, and he's not in touch with the business community of this state. The business community of this state absolutely demands that we take real action.
just closing the border is not a serious attempt at solving the whole problem. We need comprehensive immigration reform, as President Bush said and as President Obama has said.
We come now to the 60-second closing statements, and by the toss of a coin, Ron Johnson, you go first.
Thank you. I'd like to thank the University of Wisconsin-Marathon County and tonight's viewers. Wisconsin voters do have a very clear choice this election. Senator Feingold cast a deciding vote for both the failed stimulus package and the health care bill. He's also voted for the last three budgets that have increased our national debt by over $3 trillion. We simply can't afford these failed policies any longer. I offer a different direction. I've been building a business for 31 years, producing products, exporting products, creating real jobs. I'd like to use that lifetime experience to help get our economy growing again so we can start creating jobs and actually start addressing our national spending and debt issue. The idea and promise of America is something incredibly precious. America is exceptional, and it is our job to make sure it not only survives for future generations, but that it thrives. That's why I decided to run for the U.S. Senate. That's why I'm asking for your vote. Thank you, and good night.
And Senator Feingold, you have 60 seconds.
As I said at the outset, the difference between us would be whether we proposed any solutions to problems. I've talked specifically about how I would try to solve the problem of jobs and specifically how we deal with the issue of deficits. Mr. Johnson has offered none of that. And ask yourself, between the two of us, who's on your side? Who voted to control the insurance industry and not let them be in charge when it comes to health care? And who voted against those trade agreements that sent these jobs overseas? I voted against them. He thinks they're a great idea. He thinks they're good for Wisconsin. Well, what's good for Wisconsin is protecting jobs and protecting Wisconsin values. And if you give me the chance, I'd like to continue to work on that.
That concludes tonight's debate between the U.S. Senate candidates, incumbent Democrat Russ Feingold and Ron Johnson. Please, a warm round of applause for both candidates. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. We would like to thank once again tonight's sponsors, Wisconsin Public Radio, the Wausau Daily Herald, WAOW ABC TV 9, WSAW CBS TV 7, and the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Thanks to Dean Sandy Smith and the staff at UW-Marathon County. A special thanks to Eric Giordano, Rick Ryer, Chris Berg, Jane Ritker, Ian Reese, Dennis Dalsky, Katie Rosenberg, Susan Ramsett, Randy Winter, and Mike Beck for making this event possible. Finally, a big round of applause for yourselves for caring enough about this country to attend this debate. Don't forget to vote on Tuesday. Good night, everybody. That's Tuesday, November 2nd.